Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. I'm your host, E.L. King, and on this very special episode of Slay Away, we are chatting with Tim Seeley, the creator of Hack Slash, strong female characters like Cassie Hack, lover of all things horror, and he wrote the screenplay for the Shudder original, very apocalyptic, very supernatural, neon horror film, Revealer, with fellow comics author Michael Morisi. You might recognize Seeley's work as a comics creator, writer, and artist on books like Image Comics Revival, The Lost Boys Volume 1, Money Shot, and Nightwing. Revealer follows exotic dancer Angie Pettarelli, played by Cato Acey, in 1987 Chicago. Angie works the peep show booth at the Revealer's bookstore, and when the rapture throws the world outside into chaos, Angie becomes trapped, and the two must work together to escape the evil that's come to claim all of the sinners. Born, played by Shayna Shrewton.
Men and women turning on each other, tearing each other's skin with their teeth and their nails. Eyes like snakes. Screams from below, cries from above. It's the end of the world. Judgment comes to wipe your stain from the world.
Trust me, Sals. Stains coming out of my booth ain't from me.
So gross! It is the hour of our reckoning, and I have to spend it with you?
I like what I do. I don't like being shamed for it, especially by the one person who is so hot to save my soul, but can't be bothered to save me from dying in a fucking peep show booth! Messed up shit do I have to deal with in a single day?
Maybe try to be a little less aggressive. You've been scaring the customers.
Okay, Tim, so this is one of my favorite questions. It's the icebreaker. How did you discover your love of horror?
Oh, man. So when I was a kid, my dad was a big, big horror head. And he was a VHS, one of the earliest people in my neighborhood to get a VCR. You know, he was that guy. So every Friday, after school or something, we would go to this video store called Pot of Gold Video in Schofield, Wisconsin.
Oh, my gosh.
and so, he would always rent a couple things. And so I was always at the height of all these VHS covers. And I just got really fascinated with the genre. I was kind of too afraid to watch them right away, but like when I was 5 and 6, I was too afraid, but I was like compelled by it. And then, but when I was like 10, I started watching everything I get my hands on. Like that was the summer that Predator came out and Lost Boys, 1987. And so that just kind of, you know, burgeoned into this hobby of horror after that. And I was always kind of into just, you know, the horror comics as well. Again, my dad used to get Vampirella magazine and stuff. And so anything that was kind of made me, I think it's because I have anxiety, like a general anxiety disorder, that having stuff that I could be afraid of but was sort of controllable was always super like compelling to me.
Oh, yeah. I'm right there with you. I have a really severe anxiety. So horror, maybe that's how I got into it. I got into it when I was like 5.
Oh, yeah. You're a little scared. I was a little scared.
Although it was around the same time, because I turned 5 in 1990 or 1989.
Yeah. Stuff, and I do think there's psychologically something to that, like especially people who have, you know, sort of a general fear. It's really nice to have a specific fear that you can turn off, you know? So I always think that was a big part of the appeal. And I just always like monsters and hot ladies. So like 80s horror was a good time to come into that.
Well, I was going to say monsters and hot ladies. So that is a great lead into comics and horror comics specifically, and like hack slash. So did that lead you to creating hack slash, that love of hot ladies and monsters?
It did. I was in my early 20s. I got a job at a comic book company called Devil's Due Publishing. It was here in Chicago. And I moved here to start the job. But most of my job was drawing. And I was doing a lot of licensed stuff like G.I. Joe and Dungeons and Dragons. And it was a great job. And I was super happy to have it. But there was lots of restrictions, especially on G.I. Joe. So at one point, I kind of took like everything that I couldn't do in G.I. Joe and I sort of threw it in a blender. And I was like, I got to come up with something I can, you know, do for myself. And one of the things I kind of, you know, had fresh in my head was that I knew B movies sort of inside and out because I'd grown up on it. My dad, I had all this stuff, and so hack slash was kind of combining like everything I loved and also everything that I could do to be offensive as possible, because I just kind of felt like so, you know, sort of cowed by working on licensed stuff. And so hack slash is partially just like love, but it's also partially frustration, I think. And so basically it was, you know, it was designed for me to get away with the kind of stuff that I grew up on, the kind of stuff I love, that kind of subversive. But one of the approaches that I always had for it was like, what if you did slasher stuff or whatever, but there was like actual heart in it? Because a lot of that stuff obviously does not. I mean, it's not meant to. But that was kind of the genesis of making up Hack Slash. And originally the idea was that I was going to draw it, and I was going to have this, at the time, somewhat unknown writer named Robert Kirkman do it for me. And then he got super busy because he got Walking Dead became very popular. So he said no. So I was like, I'll just write it and I'll have my friend Stefano draw it. And that ended up being probably a good choice. But if I think Robert had written it, I'd probably be richer. So there's that.
Let me see. When I first met you, which must have been, I don't know, I feel like 2008, 2009, Emerald City Comic Con, maybe.
That makes sense. Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, I was like, it's got to be at least almost 15 years ago.
I got it. Okay. Yeah.
So, which is kind of wild. But I when I was talking to Luke, I told Luke that Hack Slash was when I first started collecting horror comics. And Hack Slash was kind of my gateway drug.
Always happy to hear that.
Yeah, and from that point, then I got into collecting The Walking Dead, and then I got into collecting Crossed and other really fucked up shit. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about writing and developing first the idea for Revealer and how that came about. And I didn't realize that you and Luke are both in Chicago, so it makes sense why Chicago is at the center of the apocalypse.
Well, Luke is in, he's actually downstate in Champaign, but I met him here. He comes up here a lot. So yeah, I live here. I have lived here for more than 20 years. And, you know, a lot of stuff in the 80s was set in Chicago. Obviously, a lot of the romantic comedies and such, but also Child's Play was set here. And, you know, Chicago was like kind of the America of the 80s stand-in, because it was like Midwest-y, but also it was crimey, and so that they said a lot of stuff here.
As far as developing the idea for a revealer and writing that, how did the idea come about?
So we were basically, you know, we had wanted to film something, another project before, and it was very clear COVID was going to shut down our ability to make a bigger sort of movie, but we didn't want to lose the momentum that we had. And so we still had people who were interested in like giving us money, but the rules were, if we're going to shoot this, we got to do it with all these health requirements, you know, for COVID. And this was early. It was like the May of 2020. So like, you know, we had just come out of like complete total lockdown, right? That was all March and a lot of April. And, so there was like, you know, we can shoot a movie, but it can't have more than two people on screen at any given time, indoors. It couldn't have, you know, like a cast of more than six. And so there's all these like requirements. We basically, you know, Luke and Brett, and Sarah, took, and Rob took like the requirements from the state and just gave them to Mike and I and said, here's what you can't do. So we started thinking of ideas of what you could come up with in there. And we each came up with a few ideas. So I think I had a couple, and Mike Morisi had a couple ideas. And so we'd sent those to the producers. And for me, Revealer came from, the original idea was just that I had been, for a different comic, I'd been doing a lot of like reading of biblical stuff and like books about how actual, you know, like the way that we think of demons now versus the way that they thought of them then, when they actually came up with this, how much stuff really in Christianity is sort of recent. It's kind of like, you know, the way they think of Jesus, the way they think of Satan is like within the last 50 to 100 years, all that stuff is new. And so I just want to do something going back to that. I got really interested in Revelation, which is not exactly what I thought it was going to be when I read it. And I guess, in trying to think of something we could set in a small location, I'd moved into this house in the year right before COVID lockdown, and I had a kid, and I don't get to go many places. And so, but in my neighborhood, there is, not too far in my neighborhood, is an old bookstore, an old adult bookstore, and it's changed. Now it's not what it was, but I found out it used to be a peep show booth, and I thought that was so interesting because it doesn't seem like the kind of neighborhood where that would be. So it's basically just kind of combining all these things and cooking them up. And I came up with a name for a bookstore called Revealers. Like, and I was like, oh, like Revelation. And it makes sense because it's a peep show. And so
everything came together.
That is true. Like, we talked about how things really dropped into place because we didn't have much time. I think the idea for this and then going to picking it and writing it and having a finished screenplay happened in like 2 weeks, basically.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's much faster than I thought.
In like 8 days, Mike and I wrote the script back and forth. But yeah, it was just, and it was a lot of, you know, I pulled some of the character Sally is based on this woman from my hometown who is this Christian protester. And she used to show up at the adult bookstore all the time. And she used to show up at movies and she would show at the comic book store. And you know, when they opened anything fun, she would show up and protest.
So one woman show.
Yes. And she had it. She actually started this like morality club in my hometown.
Okay.
And, you know, they were like trying to push for like, you know, obviously it was pretty small potatoes because it was just my hometown of Wausau, Wisconsin. But she was pushing for like, you know, Christian ideas and movies. And she thought kids shouldn't read horror comics and all stuff. So she was like my archenemy, I guess, as a kid, is what I thought of her. And so I based the character of Sally around this woman. And, you know, one of the sort of advantages that we talked about is like we only had 14 days, 8 days to write a script. So you just had to like pull from your memory. Like, and the 80s is something I remember very well. So like I said, the summer of 1987, I remember very well because it was all these horror movies that I love came out. I also had my appendix out that summer, so I remember the music very well because I was, you know, sitting in a hospital room with the radio on. So it just like we basically just threw everything we knew together to make the story.
Luke and I talked about it, our mutual love of 1987 and The Lost Boys, and I was like, oh, and the movie set in 1987, I get it now. So you, The Lost Boys is your favorite film, right?
It is indeed. It's my favorite.
I gotta know, what is it about The Lost Boys in particular Is it just that it was the film or soundtrack that you could listen to a lot after you had your appendix out, or something else?
Things, yeah. I think the thing I always loved about Lost Boys, I loved Lost Boys and Fright Night, which were like two movies I saw basically the same summer. And they're both vampire movies, and they're both like, if you come after those movies, you're kind of used to the world they created. Like, obviously, Buffy is based on things that they do in Lost Boys, and so is Fright Night inspired Buffy, and then all these sort of things that come after. But when those movies came out, they were like, it was like shockingly cool to have like young, hip vampires. That wasn't really a thing. Like, most of the vampire movies previous to 1987, and I love these movies, but they're like Hammer horror. It's like, you know, vampires, and it's set in like, you know, the 1890s, or and it's all very classic and gothic. And the idea of having, you know, Lost Boys and Fright Night and Near Dark, like, they all like did something at the same time, which was really new about vampires.
These cool young punk vampires, or vampires that have adapted with the times, which I think is what Interview with the Vampire, at least the film adaptation, later became. Like, they didn't just stay stuck in one era,
right?
In terms of their dress and expression, and even the hunger in 1983, right? So
totally, yeah. And vamp, obviously, but like the ideas there like seemed so just huge at the time, and you know, the kind of counterculture stuff that they use, and also it's like a metaphor for, you know, it became a metaphor for HIV, which was a big impact at the time. So I don't know, there's just like an energy to those things that because I kind of lived through it, like, it's still there. And I also think Lost Boys it's hilarious. It's like, it's a really funny, I love horror comedy. That's my favorite genre, period. And that and Fright Night are really funny movies also. Near Dark is not funny, but but you just that energy that kind of was just such so influential.
Well, I love all of those films, but in terms of writing, like, really strong, sharp-witted female characters, Angie is one of those. Cassie Hack is one of those. So you have a lot of experience with writing those types of roles. What was writing Angie like?
I mean, it's obvious that Luke always says, like, I have a type of girl, and that's like they're kind of crude.
That is what he said to me.
Yes. And so, but it also was like, well, I have to put one of those characters in here, right? But we needed someone who was the opposite of Sally. So, and it was, you know, originally the idea with Angie was just that she was just kind of fed up. Like, she had seen everything, and she was just kind of like done with all the bullshit. And so she had nothing left to hide, right? Everything about Angie was on her sleeve, which made her the opposite of Sally, who was, you know, really constricted and restrained. And so, you know, the opportunity to sort of make someone who talks crudely and wears, you know, provocative outfits, and who's comfortable with her sexuality. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of apparently my shtick. And it allowed me to, like, her to have, she has the funny lines.
I love Angie. Like, she's strong, she's intelligent, and even when Ray says something to her like, you gotta be less aggressive, you're scaring the customers, she just has that fuck you attitude towards, I guess, the patriarchy, essentially. And I love that. Something just in terms of women that we hear a lot, that we need to be, like, very meek. So she's the total opposite of that, which I appreciated. And then her comfort level in her body, her sexuality, I think it's like a very sex positive film as well, which I liked. So
yeah, absolutely. And that's a big thing. I always try to do that with my stuff. So that's a big part of Money Shot as well. You know, so, but it's like kind of a cheat, I guess, to do the sort of same thing I've done in other stuff. But when you're working fast, you sort of pull from your repertoire, right? And so, like, I'd love to do things that are out of my repertoire, like do things that involve research. Like, the comic I do, West of Sundown, is a Western, and I have to do all kinds of research, and it's really fun, but I can't do that in 8 days, right? So like, part of the thing with Revealer was, let's know what we know. And I know 80s music, and I know 80s horror movies, and I know badass funny girls, and I know sexy. Like, that's the things I know, you know? And so it allowed us, because one of the things that when Mike and I teamed up on this, we knew we would play to our strengths as well. And Mike is awesome at structure, and he knows how to do put a character through their arc and like get set something up in a series of acts. And that is something I probably would have struggled with a lot. And having Mike there, we were able to like combine our skills, and just kind of create something that is not something I don't think we would have created separately, but on its own, it's like this is a unique object that has a little bit of both of us, or a lot of bit of both of us, I guess.
Well, what other influences, either from the 1980s or elsewhere, play into the film?
Assault on Precinct 13 was a big one. All those kind of siege films, and it's like a really, that's a John Carpenter movie, but it's not really a horror movie. I guess it kind of is, but it's an action movie, I guess. But it's a low budget movie, and it's a siege story, and basically it's just, these cops and people stuck in this place, and they're being attacked by prisoners, essentially, is what it is, criminals. And so just the way that was structured, that was a big influence on what we were doing. And then also and a thing they play really well in Assault on Precinct 13 too is for a lot of the movie, you don't really see who's attacking. You just hear them, or when you do see them, it's only very briefly, and it kind of makes them very scary, which I think is what we try to pull. And then another big influence was The Beyond. A lot of those sort of Fulci type movies where the threat is a little bit sort of nebulous to some degree, or there's things in the story that are just fucking weird. That was something we wanted to bring in to the story as well. And let's see, what else did we pull from? Demons, the Bava, is it the Bava? I think the Italian horror movie with the demons, people becoming possessed and then going crazy and attacking in the movie theater.
So speaking of demons, okay, it's the Rapture. Obviously, there's going to be demons from hell. And I liked the way that the demons were represented. I also thought that they looked great because there are demons. Sally calls it out. But there's a particular scene with Angie and one of these slithering demons that was really interesting. And for me, it maybe I read too much into it, but... maybe not, but it also kind of reminded me a little bit of some of the themes from Alien.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously and Alien, this sort of idea of this kind of forced pregnancy, which obviously is relevant at the moment. And yes, that kind of stuff. There's a, there's like I think a lot of horror really sort of excels when it kind of plays upon your most intimate fears. And a lot of those are obviously physical and sexual. And so, yes, we definitely wanted to make sure that we played that up here. The snakes are, in the Bible, one of the things I had read, sort of the origin of some of the demon stories was that, the Bible kind of combines a bunch of local mythology and smaller faiths and kind of borrows things it likes the most. And obviously the most obvious one is, the sort of sun god, the sun worship. They borrowed that from the Egyptian mythology. That's Ra becomes Christ, and they also borrowed these sort of fears, these sort of mythologies where earth spirits are sort of these things that come up from the ground, and this idea that the farther you are from God's light, sun, the darker and sort of more evil you are, which is an idea that comes from sun worship, right? Then of course the things that are away from the sun would be the most dangerous. So the earth spirits and these kind of they were worms essentially in some versions of these stories. So that's kind of the thing we want to pick up, was that they were clearly meant to be these phallic objects as well. So that was
yes. I didn't say phallic, but I was like, you know what I mean.
I do.
But that's part of why I'm like, this thing looks like the creature that bursts out of the chest burster, but in worm form, which was fantastic. And I loved that. So I wanted to ask, like, is there any kind of, things like that? Obviously I hope people pick up on when they watch this film, but what's something that you hope people walk away with after watching Revealer?
I mean, I don't know. It's interesting for me now to watch the reaction to it because it's so swift with movies. It's so different in comics. You know, it's like you do a comic and you don't really hear from anybody about it until like you go to a convention and they bring up the sign and they tell you something. But with a movie, it's like it was the reactions were so instant. It was like all across social media. And so I almost hate to like tell people to look for something if they don't catch it. But what I'm liking that people are catching, you know, is that it's really a feminist story. Like I'm very happy that that part of it is, you know, resonating with people. And I hope, I love to watch people reaction to the end, the sort of like a credit scene or post credits scene where, you know, we kind of lead you to this place. And then the movie ends with you getting to like, not be 100% sure.
It's really cool. I told everyone, after Luke's interview, keep watching all the way to the end of the credits.
Yeah. And you know, that was partially that was in the script, and a version of what was in the script was what we ended up doing. And obviously, you know, COVID made some things impossible. So the original version of that, you know, was sort of in the smoke, and there had been a fire. And so they were sort of wandering through it. And it was sort of the idea that, you know, it was unsure where they were, because they couldn't see it. And then to sort of get around that, we couldn't use fire. So because of COVID and because of it's a respiratory disease and no one wanted to be breathing fake smoke. So instead we had to do this new idea. And it's just incredible what Luke and the special effects people pulled off with that. Cause it's something created sort of after the movie was shot, and it looks fucking incredible. You know, it's like the biggest effect in the movie, which I think is kind of cool. Like we saved it for the very end. But I'm loving watching how people react to it, because one of the things that we really want to do was that we left the ending sort of unclear, which is a frustration for me sometimes in comics, is you can't do that because something about the medium makes it difficult, I guess, for people to sort of, you know, if they're confused, they assume it's because they misread something. Where in a movie, like, you can just make something unclear and let people fill it in, and it's sort of obvious, I think, much more obvious than it is in comics.
Well, we have to talk about Gunship.
Happy to.
One of my absolute favorite bands, and the moment that the montage scene with Angie's dance is my absolute favorite. And from the moment that Dark All Day came on, I was like, yeah, like fuck yeah, I'm about to really enjoy this movie. So, yeah, tell me about your love of Gunship.
Oh man, so I grew up in the 80s stuff, so, and a huge Carpenter fan, so that kind of stuff is hugely my thing. And I was following a lot of the sort of resurgence of those kind of bands around because I discovered Carpenter Brut.
Oh yeah, their most recent album is awesome. I'm a big retrowave synthwave fan, so especially horror. Dance with the Dead and any of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. That's all. I'm super into that shit. That's why I write. I can't write with things to things with lyrics. So I'm always sort of grabbing a lot of that kind of music. You know, Dance with the Dead and Carpenter Brut and Night Rider.
Time Cop 1983.
Yeah. Yep.
Or Los Matos. Los Matos. Yeah,
so, but Gunship was the one. They have lyrics. And so when I discovered them, though, it was probably about 7 years ago, I was really obsessed with them. And then like 2-3 years after that, they came out with Dark All Day, which I think is their greatest record. And it was something that Luke and I would share back and forth, which was like these band these recommendations. So when we originally were working on the movie, you know, Luke had said, I want to do something with synthwave. And I was like, well, we'll never get Gunship. So, but I wrote the scene, the original dance scene with Angie dancing is to a Big Black song. I don't know if you're familiar with Big Black. It's an 80s Chicago punk band, post-punk band. Awesome stuff, produced by and sung by Steve Albini. And so we had written the scene to have that. It was actually, you know, I'd choreographed it in my head to this Big Black song. And it's why in the scene, Ray says, you always dance into that dentist drill shit, because if you've ever heard Big
Oh,
okay. Sounds like dentist drill music. Luke was adamant that he was going to get them. It's like, okay, buddy, sure. And it you know, it was something it took him a long time to get them. He filmed it, choreographed it to Dark All Day, hoping that we would get them to release the rights to it. And they did. It was actually not like, it was something fairly late in the game. Late enough that when I saw the cut that we were going to send to Shudder, Luke hadn't even told me that he secured the rights to it. And I was watching it.
Wow. My face,
holy shit. Is this actually going to have Gunship in it? And he was like, surprise.
That's awesome. Well, I'm super excited because I read about the Revealer tie-in comic as well.
Yes.
And I've already purchased both the A and B covers. So tell me more about the tie-in book for Revealer from Vault Comics. I want to know everything.
It's something we talked about doing from the very beginning. The problem with it is trying to time it. And, you know, we had to wait. We were working on comics ideas and stuff that we wanted to do in the comic, but we didn't know when Shudder was going to release on the movie. We had to wait till them to decide, like, their own schedule. So it was, you know, it was kind of a thing where all of a sudden we had the release date. We're like, okay, time to go. We got to get this together. But I had done the cover, you know, back in like a month or two after Luke finished filming the movie. So the cover has been done for almost more than 2 years, actually. I think 2 years. But it was just a, you know, timing this out and giving it comics. You have to solicit them, and then it has to. It's 3 months before they come out, so it's like it's a little bit later than we would have liked. But you just can't. There's nothing we can do. You know, we don't know when the movie is going to come out. So, but it's going to have stories. All of us are contributing one. I wrote one. Mike wrote one. Aaron wrote one. John Huff did one, I think. But there's, you know, all stories of stuff we could not do in the movie because of the budget. So, you know, there's an Angie story. There's a Sally story.
Oh, great. It's going to be expansive because I wasn't sure if it was going to be just a single issue comic for the film, just the film, or if there was going to be additional issues.
It's sort of like a one shot, but it has, you know, four or five stories in it.
Oh, great. Okay.
So there's Angie One Sally. There's a, what's his name? Asmodeus origin story. And it's like a big cosmic thing. That's what I'm writing.
Does Ray have a story?
I don't think does Ray have a story? I think he appears in one. But yeah, you get to see like all those sort of aspects of things that we, you know, things we talked about, things we wanted to shoot, but COVID shut us down. And it'll have some awesome artists. My artist on Money Shot is drawing one of them. A classic Conan artist named Ken Landgraf is drawing one. Chris Anderson, who's a horror comic book artist, is drawing one. So it's going to be it's a great looking book, and all the proceeds go to charity. So we're just doing some. It's basically just for fun for us, I think, and we hope the fans get something out of it.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to close with asking you what's next. So Luke, let me know that you're both headed to a Comic-Con sometime in August, hopefully around the time that the book comes out, the comic book.
Oh, C2E2, yeah.
Yes, C2E2. And what's next for you after that? What do you got coming up? Anything you can share?
I got all kinds of stuff. Yes, I have, I've got the comics. I have The Roadie, which is a sort of heavy metal horror story about old retired roadie from back in the 80s whose actual job during the time was to exile the demons that the band accidentally summoned with their music, and now he's sort of living off in the middle of nowhere, and he's called back in to the scene that he's kind of forgotten him, and he is forgotten, and so that's coming from Dark Horse Comics. I believe that starts in August or September, I think. And then I've got Money Shot, which is my Vault comic series. That will return, I believe, in October. And West of Sundown, which is my Western, that's coming out right now. Issue 4, I think, is out next week. That's a Western horror story with artist Jim Terry and co-writer Aaron Campbell. And Spider-Gwen, I'm writing that series for Marvel right now. Issue 3 just came out. What else? I got all kinds of shit. I got two more horror series that are going to be announced in the coming weeks, I believe. And if you Never checked it out. Try out. I wrote a book called a comic called Chronophage, which is a horror romance science fiction kind of thing. It's one of my favorite things I've ever done. And that came out from Humanoids Publishing.
Fantastic. Lots of options. Any additional future forays into film writing?
I don't have anything on the table right now. I don't know. I wasn't sure that would be something I wanted to do. I actually really enjoyed it. So I would definitely like to do more stuff. I got to figure out like, what do you follow up a movie with? What do you follow up something like Revealer with? I guess I have to be more serious this time. I don't know.
I don't know. You could do more of the same because it's really good.
So, I don't know. I mean,
if you were given more time to write a film script that was taking maybe the same universe but a different story, like,
yeah,
would you pursue it?
I mean, that's actually something we talked about. Is that, you know, we could do the thing where we do like the Evil Dead, where the sequel to this is like a bigger budget version. But we were thinking about like the problem that we have here, and it's not like Cube or something. Like, it's a low budget. That's a low budget movie, and then they do a sequel, and it's just the idea. But I think the problem with that is that how do you do a sequel of this movie if you don't have Kato and Shayna, right? Because they are the heart of this. This thing works because of them. So we kind of feel like though the movie kind of contains them to some degree, it sort of ends them. I don't know if you'd want to do a story without them.
I think it'd be really tough. I agree it would be tough, and I don't want to give the ending away by saying what I hope would happen if there were a sequel.
Direction we could go is we could Army of Darkness it, right? Like,
yeah. Something. Yeah.
Like, it would be a different genre essentially, right? Because like, mm-hmm. You know, Army of Darkness is a different genre than Evil Dead, right? It's like it's a fantasy sword and sorcery, wacky movie, adventure movie, and
it's Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways.
With that, yes, true.
Well, I didn't ask you before when you told me about your horror origin story what your favorite horror film is, or maybe your top five.
Okay, I got that. I can figure that out. I mean, yes, I said Lost Boys. That's definitely up there. Fright Night is up there. Again, I'm recognizing, you know, that these are my favorite, not necessarily the best. You know, these ones I just really like.
Totally fine. No judgment.
The original Halloween, that's a major favorite. Let's see. I also love, obviously, Evil Dead 2 is a big one. And then, I don't know, I got to pick a Hammer movie. I mean, I love the original Universal horror stuff, too. But I'm going to pick, I love the Hammer film, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. It's a great movie. It's like the perfect Hammer flick. That's a really good one too.
I just started getting into Hammer horror last summer, so it was like a long time coming. I did a 100 horror movies in 92 days that you've never seen before challenge.
Wow, holy shit.
And so I was like, well, why don't I just watch a bunch of the Hammer horror films because I've never seen them before.
Yeah, they're great.
So I just went down the list of Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
That's a good choice. And it's great, those movies, they kind of did the sort of extended universe kind of thing, you know, so they're kind of part of the same world, sort of, in so much as they all are guests sort of based on like basically three novels, Dracula, Frankenstein, and Camilla, right? They're all kind of set in that. So, but yeah, I love those two. If you haven't seen Twins of Evil, that's my second favorite one.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on to chat with me about Revealer and horror and all that good stuff. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it too. Thank you.